afternoon, folks. Great to be here. Haven't been here for a while. This is Dave Gahary. I'm filling in for Deanna Spingola. Deanna asked me, it was probably a couple months ago, I think, to host her show today. I think because we are just 2 days away from the 53rd observance of the USS Liberty massacre, and Deanna knows that I've been working on a project to get the story out to as many people as possible, and so I'm happy to be here and happy to speak to her audience and happy to take calls from anyone and everyone. And I imagine you all know the number, but we'll go through that later on. And we are going to be talking about the USS Liberty and really anything else that folks would want to talk about. Today, of course, is June 6th, and that is a very important date. Not now so much as it used to be, of course, because with time, everything seems to just go away. And that is something that's happening with D-Day, the Normandy landings, which began on Tuesday, June 6th, 1944. And the significance of those landings is that these turned the tide of World War II. And I'm personally not taking a position on that. I'm not really a World War II aficionado. I don't know enough about it to really discuss it. I was born in 1960, and I have not spent a lot of time on World War II. But the significance of today is that in 1944, so we're talking 56 plus 20, 76 years ago today, was when Operation Neptune swung into action, the largest seaborne invasion in history. And of course, on June 8th, 1967, 53 years ago on Monday, when June 8th is, was the day that the unarmed surveillance ship, the USS Liberty, AGTR-5, was viciously attacked by the Zionist State of Israel, where 34 Americans were horribly murdered. And I'm figuring, because there really isn't a real accurate number, and there's a reason for it, and we'll get into that later on, but probably at least 200 were wounded out of a crew of 294. And it might even be more than that. I mean, the entire crew was injured psychologically because of this attack. But physically, I don't know if all of them were injured, but pretty close to almost all of them, probably between a 75 to 100% casualty rate, whether it's physical and or mental. And this was an unprovoked attack. Like I said, Liberty was not a warship. So we're going to be talking about that. And we also have a special guest with us today, who was one of the survivors of that massacre. And we're going to bring Al in later on, Alan Easton. And it just so happens that the 53rd reunion for the survivors was supposed to take place actually this weekend in Pensacola. That was the location they had selected, but because of this virus, that was canceled. And so Al had bought a particular ticket that he couldn't get a refund on, and he was going to make the trip out here anyway, and I had interviewed Al for the book, and he was coming out anyway, so it was just natural that we would get together. And I picked him up at the airport last night and late last night, and he's here with me now, and we'd love to. And Al has never spoken on radio before. He's a private person, but his story is significant, just as every other Liberty survivor's story is significant. And Al has a special significance because of his interaction with someone who was brought aboard the Liberty to sort out the dead from the wounded from the live. And we'll get into that also later on. So Alan Easton is here with us, who spent over 20 years in the U.S. Navy serving his country. So with that, I will say that, and you folks know how this goes, the schedule here, at about 20 minutes after the hour, there's a commercial, and for a few minutes, and then we're back again for about 5 minutes, and then it goes in and out throughout the time. We have a long segment here for you in the beginning, and the listen line, and I'm looking at the website here, it looks like it's area code 701, then 801, then 3663, and of course then there's plenty of ways to listen to this show live online or through your telephone, 605-313-0163, 605-313-0163. And to comment on air, to call with any questions, it's 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443. And I'm reading that off of the republicbroadcasting.org website. And it also says here, if you have trouble connecting to that 605-313-0163 number, that there's particular numbers here for T-Mobile, AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, and others, and those numbers are on the website of republicbroadcasting.org. And, of course, then there's talkstreamlive.com, which might be a good site to listen to. The producer said that he has luck with that, so you might want to try that. talkstreamlive.com/program/RBN, and you'll see it right there, and you can just listen to it in that fashion. So, as I said, the USS Liberty, 53 years ago on Monday, was patrolling the Eastern Mediterranean during the so-called Six-Day War, where Israel had launched an attack on its Arab neighbors, a premeditated, unprovoked attack on Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. And the significance of what happened almost 53 years ago, actually it was 53 years ago because today's the 6th, and this Six-Day War began on the 5th, which was, I think, about a week earlier than was scheduled. And the reason that they did it a week earlier was because the vice president of Egypt was in D.C. hoping to ratchet down tensions, and Israel found out about it, and they didn't want any tensions ratcheted down. And the reason was because the main purpose of the Six-Day War was their illegal land grab. And this is what has created, and this is something that many people don't realize, that this illegal land grab that happened 53 years ago, because when the Liberty was sailing in the Eastern Mediterranean, in international waters, minding its own business, just trying to pick up communication signals. Israel was occupying the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank of the Jordan River, and the last piece that they wanted to get was the Golan Heights in Syria. And, of course, we've heard about the Golan Heights in the news relatively recently, that the Israelis want to call it Trump Heights or something like that, because Trump recognized the Golan Heights as Israeli territory. I don't know how he could do that, because it's a Syrian piece of property, but nonetheless, he recognized that the Golan Heights belongs to Israel. And Israel, of course, was very happy that he did that, because he really is the great friend of Israel. Some people, instead of calling it MAGA, Make America Great Again, it's MEGA, Make Israel Great Again, which seems to be happening. Of course, they just got approved their $38 billion over 10 years, plus. While Americans here are struggling, that doesn't seem to matter. But the significance of this six-day war, actually, there's two main parts to, actually, I should say three main parts to this six-day war that we are still feeling the effects of. One is the illegal land grab. Because they grabbed this land illegally and they held on to it, this is the main reason why terrorism exists in the United States today. And I'm not talking about these domestic terrorists, Antifa, and all those other outfits that are probably run by Schwartz Jorgi, which is George Soros. That's his real name. In Hungary, they reverse the given name and the surname. So it's George Schwartz. That's his name. He just changed it to George Soros. I'm talking about the Muslim terrorists and Islamic terrorism. That was created because of Israel's illegal land grab. So prior to the Six-Day War, or prior to the first attacks on the United States by Muslims, Arabs, Islamists, the only terrorism that existed in the United States was from Puerto Ricans for their nationalist movement. There was no such thing as Arab terrorism. The reason it existed and exists is because Israel never gave the land back. They tried to speak to Israel and say, hey, you know, this is our land, give it back. That's like, you know, another country coming into the United States and occupying, let's say, New York, Manhattan, say, okay, we're taking it over now. You know, that wouldn't last long, obviously, but the point is that this is what created the terrorism in the United States. And this is a documented fact. There's a book called Blind Spot about the history of counterterrorism in the United States that clearly points that out. And there's plenty of other sources. So because Israel was allowed to get away with that illegal land grab, we have terrorism in the United States. Because Israel was allowed to massacre American servicemen in international waters without any repercussions, they realized that if they could do that, then they could basically do whatever they want. And that's what happened. And the final significance, and not the final, but a significant part of the Six-Day War, the result, the fallout, is that it wasn't until after Israel murdered 34 Americans and wounded, as I said, probably over 200, and all of them, at least psychologically, the United States was not providing Israel with money or weapons. The first weaponry that was provided to Israel was limited, and that had begun under JFK, when JFK realized the electoral significance for him of giving stuff to Israel because of American Jews, because of their allegiance to a foreign power, Israel. So he realized that by handing out goodies to a foreign power, Israel, that American Jews would vote for him. And that kind of explains how we got to the point we've gotten to right now, sadly. So the three main pieces of the Six-Day War that continue to affect us today, the illegal land grab and the terrorism that came with it, and of course we've got this whole war on terror, not because 19 Muslims in a cave with box cutters took down the World Trade Center, but because that was planned, obviously, as everyone knows and should know, that Israel could murder viciously Americans in international waters, not just on the high seas, but anywhere, and not just get away with it, but be rewarded by getting more money than they ever got before and more military armaments. They got a bunch of F-4 Phantoms the following year, I believe it was, after they committed their dirty deed on the USS Liberty. So the USS Liberty is a very important piece of history because of those issues. And there are many other issues that have been affected by the Liberty and the attack on the Liberty, which I used to call it an attack. I never called it really incident. That's something that a lot of people might use, or attack, but it really was a massacre. What they did was they massacred these boys, and most of them were boys. Al, how old were you?
20 years old.
20 years old is a boy. Obviously, they're 19, 20, 21, 22, some were a little older. They did murder the executive officer, who was, I believe, in his 30s, and he had, I think, 5 or 6 children at home. So they did a lot of damage, and they want this to go away. They do not want you or anyone else to know about it, because if the story does get out the way that it should, it would be a game changer, and it wouldn't be good for Israel. And that's why they've snuffed out any attempt to get this out. I will say that it is right now going on 3:19 in a few seconds. And as I said before, we get bumped out in about 30 seconds. I'm going to give the phone number again for call-ins, and we'll take call-ins at any time. The call-in number is 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443, and you can visit the website where you can learn about the Liberty at erasingtheliberty.com. Just like erasing a blackboard, erasingtheliberty.com. And we'll see you after the break.
It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to
Oops. Welcome back. Good to have you here as we discuss very, very significant historical piece of history, the USS Liberty. And again, if anyone would like to talk about that or matters that impinge upon the Liberty, we have some folks listening, which is great. Great to have you aboard. Suzanne, thank you for listening. And got an email from Shem. Thank you, Shem. Appreciate that. So let's talk about how this happened and why it happened. Why did the USS Liberty find itself in the middle of a war zone? Well, at the time, there were events that had happened with Egypt, where the president of Egypt had closed down the Straits of Tehran, a waterway that was used for commercial shipping. But it didn't significantly impact Israel. Maybe I think it was 2-3% of their commercial shipping went through those straits. But Israel had been always looking for a way to grab that land to make their position more secure. The Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, which is the West Bank of the Jordan River, and the Golan Heights. And they used this as the justification to do that. And this was in the works for quite some time. In fact, there was the 1956 Suez Crisis that unfolded in a similar fashion, but Britain, France, and Israel teamed up to go after Nasser's Egypt. And that was when Eisenhower told them. This was when the United States actually was independent and not controlled by the Zionists the way that they are today. Eisenhower told all of them, the Brits, the French, and the Israelis, or whatever you want to call them, Jews, Israelis, you pick the term, to back off, get out of Egypt. And they all listened. They didn't want to. But this Six-Day War, which obviously happened in 67, so 11 years after, roughly, this had been in the works for a while. And if you know anything about it, you'll hear people say, well, it was a brilliant victory over the Arabs. Israel knocked out the Egyptian Air Force in 80 minutes. The planes didn't even leave. They weren't even able to take off. They did the same to Syria and Jordan. They actually used deception to intercept communications and what they call cook the messages, you know, pretend that they were Egypt telling Jordan that they were beating the heck out of the Israelis and, you know, you might as well go into the West Bank and take that. And so it was a situation where, or it is a situation where, it is, not was, it is a situation where conventional wisdom teaches that Israel was brilliant in defeating the Arab countries, when the facts are completely different. And the reason they are is because, and the reason that Egypt's planes were on the ground was because they weren't planning on attacking Israel. Nasser was just rattling his saber because he had to save face with his countrymen and the other Arab countries. So that's why Israel was able to hit Nasser's planes on the ground without them really fighting back, because it was a preemptive attack by Israel. They weren't defending themselves. But in the United States, the what people might call the Jews media, and the reason they call it the Jews media is because the media was, the modern media was created by Jews. And if you don't understand that, then you need to learn that, and you need to read books and study different arenas about this topic, whether it's books or magazines or online or listen to interviews. The Jews created the modern media, and the media here in the United States during that time, during that Six-Day War, they were primarily, of course, rooting for Israel and saying that Israel had to defend itself, and American Jews swung into action and held a bunch of demonstrations to pressure Johnson to helping Israel, although Israel didn't need any help because the war was over by the time they went after the Liberty. We'll be back some more. On this day, June 6, 2020. Right now it is 3:33 p.m. Central Time, or military would be 15:33 Central Time, and we're talking about the USS Liberty, and we left off at Israel's brilliant victory over the Arab states in the war, which wasn't a brilliant victory because they preemptively attacked, and Egypt and Syria and Jordan didn't realize that Israel would attack. So it was a preemptive attack. And not only that, another reason why it was not a brilliant victory. And in 1973, in October of 1973, which was the so-called Yom Kippur War, that was a war that was precipitated by the Arabs. And the reason that war occurred was because Israel had refused to get to the bargaining table to discuss giving the land back to the people they stole it from. And because they kept refusing to do it, the Arabs said, that's enough, we're attacking. And they almost overran Israel. So Israel wasn't brilliant then. They almost lost Israel. And of course, if that would have happened, then there existed the possibility that they might have used their nuclear weapons along the lines of something called the Samson option, which means that if we're going down, everyone else is. And that's documented in a book called Samson Option by Seymour Hersh. But the reason that 1967, the Six-Day War from June 5 to June 10, so 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 6 days, wasn't so brilliant was because at the time, and today as well, there were Jews living in the Arab countries, in Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Iran, everywhere around the world, who were spying for Israel, just as they are today. And because they were able to blend in to their host countries, which is a term that they use to describe the countries they are living in, host countries, because they were able to blend in, they were able to and not draw the attention that they might draw ordinarily. And one of these spies, matter of fact, I saw several months ago, it might be a series or a movie, I don't know, because I don't watch TV or I don't waste time on this crap that they spew. But this one Israeli spy by the name of Levy there is a series, I think, about him on Netflix, or they're trying to turn him into a hero, of course. But what he did was, in Egypt, he had befriended certain high-ranking members of the Egyptian military. And one of the things he did was he pretended that he cared for the Egyptian soldiers who were out in the desert, as lookouts. And he said, you know, these poor guys are standing out here in the sun, and, you know, they don't have any shade. I will buy some trees for them, and they can look out still, but they'll be under the shade. And for the Six-Day War, those trees were used as markers of where to attack. That's just one of the examples. There were many other examples where Jewish spies who were Egyptian, but they were not really Egyptian, they were Jews who had their allegiance to Israel, they had spied on certain sectors of the Egyptian economy, the Egyptian military, the Egyptian bureaucracy, and they had gotten that information back to Israel. So it wasn't that they were brilliant, it's that they spied. And they're still spying today. The United States has been damaged severely by Jewish spies, but somehow they seem to get away with it. So the Six-Day War came and went in June of 1967. The Liberty got hit the way that it did. They made sure that they cleaned it up and brought it back to the United States, not even to its own home port. They brought it back to the United States and almost silently let it slink back in, and then they decommissioned it and sold it for scrap. And warned, of course, threatened the sailors, civilians, and Marine. There were three Marines. Two of them were blown up by the torpedo or drowned. There were there were two remaining civilians. One was obliterated by the torpedo. And they warned the sailors, civilians, and Marine to never talk about what happened, or they would face severe repercussions. And as a matter of fact, Al, who's here with me, Al was delivered that same message. It was delivered to him. And being in the military and following orders and being young, which is something that they bank on, which we all did pretty much. He did it. And I want to bring Al in, and I would like Al, if you could, for the listeners, just give the listeners a little background about yourself, when you were born, where you're from, and how you went into the Navy, and what you were planning on doing in the Navy, and how you got on the Liberty.
Well, I was born in a little town called Clifford in Michigan. Probably the population wasn't greater than 300 at any given time. And I actually got kicked out of high school first week of my senior year for skipping a day of school. And my mother, I was very stressful on my mother. And I said, you know what? I'm going to get going in the armed forces and before my mom has a nervous breakdown. And so my dad took me down to the recruiters, and he wanted me to go in the Air Force. And I said, I don't want to go in the Air Force. And he wanted me to go in the Army because he was in the Army Air Corps before it was Air Force. And I didn't want to go there. My cousin had been in the Navy during the Korean War, and I thought he looked sharp in a Cracker Jack uniform. And I said, you know what? I want to do what my cousin did. I want to join the Navy, and I want to sail and see the world. I want to see other places besides the United States. So traveling was foremost on my list. Well, after basic training in Great Lakes, they sent me to Communication Technician Old Branch School, which was a teletype operator. And after 5 weeks at the school, I said, I don't want to be a teletype operator. And I got in arguments with the chief instructor, the head chief instructor, and finally the training officer. And the training officer finally threw his hands up in the air and said, I sent him to the fleet. And so that's how I got sent to the Liberty. Now, Old Branchers were the majority that were killed on a torpedo attack. So of the 25 personnel that was killed in a torpedo attack, majority was Old Branch teletype operators. And so I went to the Liberty, and at first they thought I was there to be a CT, and they were going to berth me with the CTs, and they said, well, wait, no, you're going to the deck department. That was fine with me. And I learned how to run small boats and stuff, and I enjoyed it. And so sometimes I think that maybe they thought by sending me to the Liberty that it was punishing me if I was to see how well the CTs had it and what was to come of their future assignments in the Navy, and which most of them had very good shore assignments. But I was happy on the deck force, and then I became a yeoman and for the deck department, and then finally the ship's office. So at the time of the attack, I was opening up ship's office after we had just finished a general quarters drill. And we were doing lots of general quarters drills prior to the assault on the Liberty.
Al, thank you for explaining that. We got a caller.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, let's take the caller, and thank you, Ken. So we've got John in California. So go ahead, John.
At the end of Bengala, I don't know, a year ago or something. Anyway, before I might get on my topic, I have a question. Are you still doing any writing for American Free Press? I don't see your name on their head anymore.
No, I actually resigned from writing for AFP and TBR last November. So November 17th, I just don't have the time.
I see your name still on TBR's list, but I'm sorry about that. I miss your underground interview columns in AFP.
I appreciate it.
Whatever you had to do. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. But I know you're working on the a movie or something. I hope that comes through. I know there one other time, I guess Tito Howard tried it. I don't know if that was, I guess it wasn't successful.
Well, that but, was, what's been done have been lower quality documentaries. And documentaries are not what's going to, you know, get this story out to the masses, to the sleepwalkers. What's going to get this story out is what's called a docudrama, which is a full-length feature film based on historical fact, but not a narrative, not a fiction film, but an actual film based on a true story. And that's what the sleepwalkers like to watch, and they like infotainment. They don't like documentaries generally, and even with documentaries, you will just have survivors talking about what happened, which will not be enough to wake them up.
Okay, well, like I said, I wish you luck in what you're doing with this, and I hope it comes out. Anyway, what I'm going to talk about, you have Al there. I was in the Navy in Vietnam in 70 through 73 active, and I stayed in the reserve another 8 years, almost 10 years total. But I, of course, nobody knew anything about that. What I found about the Liberty when I found out about the spotlight before AFP in the mid-70s, and I subscribed, and I started reading. They told the story, and I started reading about that, and I you know, it's so hard to believe that but anybody, when I was still in the Navy Reserve, nothing was about that or anything, and sounded like you didn't want to bring anything up about that. And even my stepdaughter, she was an Academy graduate from the Navy in the 90s, and she was a pilot over in the Middle East, stayed in for 10 years and got out, and she knew nothing about it. I don't broach it because I don't think she'd believe anything it said, but that's really sad. One thing about Al can ask this question, how many survivors are still left? I know there's Phil Turney and a couple others that I've heard talk, but I don't know anybody else. Can you tell me that?
I have no clue as to how many survivors are left, because on our reunions, there's only a certain percentage show up, far below the number that are probably still alive. And I don't know anybody that's keeping a tally on the survivors.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Like, sad, because I know that, like you said, you were told not to say anything. I don't know if their families knew or anything, and they were told not to say anything. What about that?
The Liberty, I separated out on the 13th of December, 1967. I was a kiddie cruiser, so I signed up before I was 18. I was to get out before I was 21. They let me out early. And I left knowing that I couldn't tell my family or friends or anyone about the Liberty. I was supposed to refer any questions to the public affairs officer for the ship or the Navy. And so I blanked the Liberty out of my mind. I just put it completely out of my mind. I just went off on my own and finally went to work for General Motors. But the Liberty, I didn't talk about it. And I was surprised at 1995 that there was a reunion for the Liberty in San Diego. And that was the first time I went and saw shipmates and whatever since I left in December of 67.
All right, well, that's too bad. I did hear one other thing some years ago. I think it was through AFPs. They had about some survivors tried to start a museum. I don't know if it was up in Wisconsin or something, and they were trying to, and they wouldn't let them do it, or they, you know, tried to, and it didn't work out. So I was sorry about something like that, trying to just make a memory of it. So anyway, I appreciate all the work you've done, Dave, and Al, good luck to whatever happens. I hope they can keep the reunions going as long as they can, and with survivors. Do you know if Phil Turney is still doing anything? I haven't heard about him lately.
Yes, Phil, of course, is still trying to get the story out there, absolutely. And in reference to your question about how many survivors are still alive, as Al said, that's accurate. There isn't any official tally of that. But since I started working on this project, several have passed on. I believe four have passed on. So there haven't been more than that. But if there were 294 on board, there might be less than 100 who are no longer with us, including the 34 murdered by Israel. So I think there's a good number of them still alive, but as Al said, the majority of them don't appear to have any interest in getting involved with reunions or anything like that. They probably just would prefer to just forget about it.
Yeah, I guess I can understand that, what they've been through and what they're afraid might happen if it keeps going. Anyway, thank you very much, Dave, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, we'll be back, and we've got two callers. We have Bill in Florida and Chance in West Virginia. Looking forward to talking to Bill and Chance. See you in a little bit. Thank you. And thank you again, John, in California, for your kind words. That was very nice, what you said about my writing for AFP and TBR. And that means a lot to me. And I didn't mean to not say enough about that, because for me anyway, you know, I like to write sometimes, and of course, when folks say something like that, it means a lot to me. So let's go to Bill in Florida. Bill, what's on your mind?
Hello.
Yeah, hello? Go ahead, Bill.
Hello.
Go ahead, Bill.
Can you hear me all right?
Yes. Yes. Please go ahead.
Okay. I appreciate what you gentlemen are doing today. And I have some pretty specific inquiries. I think it's really irregular that Mr. McGonigal received the Congressional Medal of Honor in a unique private ceremony decades after the event, when Philip McCutcheon Armstrong received the Navy Cross. I'd like to know a little bit about the circumstances of that ceremony, if you know anything about it, and why it took Mr. McGonigal more than two decades to speak out critically about the handling of it. And I'd also further be interested in any insights that either of you may have as to what specific personages were bringing pressure to bear on the families and the sailors themselves to not say anything about Israel, and how Israel got off with a $12 million ransom. Also, an additional inquiry would be about the national origin of the eight pilots who did the killing. I have been told by people that are a lot closer to me than me to the situation, rather, that these pilots, that as many as seven of eight of them were dual citizens of the U.S. I don't know whether that's true, but I thought that you might have some information. Again, though, the critical question here is, how is it that a guy who receives shrapnel wounds in his legs receives the highest award that this country can get, the Congressional Medal of Honor, 2.5 decades after the fact, in a unique private ceremony, when Philip McCutcheon Armstrong, getting strafed, getting his body cut in half, throwing flaming drums of fuel overboard, receives the Navy Cross? How does that work?
Hey, when we come back, we will get to that question. So just hang on the line, Bill, and after the break, get right back.
Thank you.
To the show. This is Dave Gahary filling in for Deanna Spingola, and with me is Alan Easton, who is a USS Liberty survivor. And Alan and I have spoke over the past year and texted, and we never met, but this is the first time. It's great to meet him, great to have him here, and great to have him taking part in the show. So, Bill, let's get to your question. And the question is, about William McGonagall, who was the skipper of the USS Liberty. He was at the time a commander, but when you're in charge of a Navy ship or boat, a boat being like a submarine, which is what I was on in the Navy, you are called the captain or the skipper, but he was a commander at the time. And his actual award was handed to him in a ceremony almost a year after the massacre. So it wasn't 2 decades or 2.5 decades. You might have been alluding to when he actually said something. He spoke out publicly about it. And I think that that was the 30th reunion, which was in 1997, and he passed on in March of 1999. So that was the first time he publicly said that, you know, he doesn't believe everything that they've been saying, that the government has been saying, and that he said we deserve more, you know, a more thorough answer than what we're given. There are people who think that he was in on it, that you know, he had something to do with, you know, the attack, in the sense that he was like an insider, which is not true, obviously. It's ridiculous. But there are some people who believe that he was given something for keeping his mouth shut, like a promotion from commander to captain. He was given a command of another ship, and he was also given the Medal of Honor, which some people think that it's called the Congressional Medal of Honor, but it's not. It's just called a Medal of Honor. That's its official term, I believe. So that was in the Washington Navy Yard. I think it was on June 10th of 1968, I believe. I'm going to look it up as I speak right now, because I don't want to give out the wrong information. But I'm pretty sure that that was the date that he was in a very obscure ceremony by the Secretary of the Navy, not by the President of the United States, which is how it's typically handled. There were a few other instances where people were not given the Medal of Honor in the White House by the president. Captain McGonagall actually researched that and found out when those, who those people were and the circumstances surrounding that. So that was actually, it was June 11th, 1968 was when the ceremony took place. And one of the reasons that he was relegated to this inferior status was because of Israel. When Israel found out, because of the number of spies that have infested the United States government then and now, that he was going to get the Medal of Honor, that McGonagall would get the Medal of Honor, the Israeli embassy spokesman, and I'm reading this, wrote that the Pentagon summary chronicled the attack in detail and exonerated McGonagall of wrongdoing. More importantly, he wrote that the report might prove politically damaging for Israel. This announcement includes denunciation of the Israeli attack that is defined as a rash act. It insists that the incident took place in international waters and that the Liberty had the right to be in them. It notes that Israeli airplanes were seen circling above the ship about 6 hours before the attack itself. It assumes with certainty that these aircraft had identified the Liberty immediately and had communicated this observation to the headquarters in Tel Aviv. All of these things are true, the United States had a right to denounce the Israeli attack and call it a rash act and insist that it took place in international. In other words, how dare the United States insist that the incident took place in international waters? Yes, but it did. It doesn't matter. It's going to damage Israel. And you cannot give him the award, or Johnson cannot give him the award. It would draw too much attention to what we did to the Liberty, to the U.S. Navy, to the United States of America. So Israel had its way, and they made sure they applied pressure, and McGonagall was disgraced, as were all of the people who served aboard the Liberty itself as a ship, the United States Navy, and every citizen of the United States of America. Israel took precedence, supremacy over the United States, even for something like this.
There are human beings. I have other questions, and I stated them. Okay, and that was a very lengthy response.
Hold on a second. I know that you have other questions and that you stated them. What I said was, I hope that answers your question.
Not really. Okay. My question, more specifically,
so I can answer that.
McGonagall received the Medal of Honor, which, by the way, there is a Congressional Medal of Honor Foundation and several other organizations that phrase it thus. Okay. How does he receive the Medal of Honor, given his injuries and given the level of his heroics, when balanced against the same for Philip McCutcheon Armstrong? How does that work? Look at what Armstrong did, and look at what McGonagall did, and answer me that.
So your question is, why did McGonagall get the Medal of Honor? And it is the Medal of Honor. It's not the Congressional Medal of Honor. It's presented in the name of Congress and is often referred erroneously as the Congressional Medal of Honor, the official name.
So that the Congressional Medal of Honor Foundation is hopelessly out of step then. Okay, you've clarified that for
us. Yes. So just because a foundation is named that doesn't mean that the name of the medal is going to change. So you're asking, why would Captain McGonagall get the highest and most prestigious military decoration awarded in the United States for what he did? And why would Armstrong, who was the XO, get the award that he did, because you're saying that Armstrong did more than the captain? Is that your point?
I think that's pretty clear. He paid the ultimate price doing superhuman heroics by all accounts. I don't hear any accounts other than, you know, walking through napalm that were particularly heroic on the part of the commanding officer.
Well,
I think it's really straining credulity to suggest that there's any comparison.
Well, there's a long history of higher ranking officers getting higher awards than lower ranking officers because of the politics involved. But I think that most of the Liberty survivors have a lot of respect for what McGonagall did. And he stayed at his post. He was bleeding pretty significantly from the leg. He was even lying down at times, but he would not leave the bridge. And many of them, if not most of them, credit him with avoiding the other four torpedoes that missed. So I think that to look at the executive officer and what he did and compare it to what McGonagall did doesn't really benefit anything in the story of the Liberty, because
unless it's your family, and then it matters a lot. But I appreciate your response to that. What about my other question?
Yes.
Who specifically? Can you do some externalization of the hierarchy on the specific personages involved on the gag orders?
Yes, sure. I'll answer that. And then I'll answer the question about the pilots. Initially, the orders given to the crew members of the Liberty to not talk about what they experienced was given by the admiral who came aboard while the Liberty was limping to Malta for repairs, and that was Admiral Isaac Kidd. And Kidd called various crew members together into sick bay or to whatever rooms that he did, and he asked them what happened. He took notes, and then when they were done saying what they had to say, then he warned them and threatened them that they are never to talk about this to anyone, not their family, friends, the media, or they would suffer severe consequences. And as Al said, he put it out of his head, which a lot of them did. They even forgot the date, a lot of them. And so...
Amazing. Really amazing. You know, Isaac Kidd also says that you shouldn't pay attention to the claims that Israel attacked the USS Liberty deliberately, which is really interesting given his own genealogy. I mean, doesn't that strike you as interesting?
Well, yes. What's interesting about the Kidd story, and what most people don't know because it hasn't been revealed yet, which it will be, is that Kidd spoke to different groups of the crew in different ways. So where he would handle the enlisted by taking off his stars and talking to them as if he was concerned and he was their father, and then after they spilled their guts, he would threaten them and hope to scare the crap out of them. After he put the stars back on and said, okay, now I'm an admiral again. With the officers and the civilians, and there were only two civilians left because one was destroyed by the torpedo, he talked to them as equals and commiserated with them and cursed out Israel, besides the fact about what we know about what him and Ward Boston discussed because of that Israeli-American Jewish traitor, Ahron J. Crystal, the Florida bankruptcy judge who's still alive, who wrote the book The Liberty Incident. That's what motivated Ward Boston to come forward and say, hold on a second, wrong. So, yes, there's more sides to Admiral Kidd than people know about.
Yes, Itzhak Kidd.
Yes.
Okay, so yes. This tells you, your country is attacked, 30-plus personnel are murdered, some 170 injured, and the rest traumatized. The country not only does not respond with force, not only does not report, not only puts a gag order on all of these sailors and all of their families, but goes on to decade after decade of massacre in the name of the Rothschild state, when this state has not shed a single drop of blood on behalf of this country. Now, who's accountable for that?
And I wouldn't argue with that in the least. You're cricket. 100% right. Who's accountable for that? Our leaders.
Who's accountable?
Our leaders.
Specifically, you're there to reveal the method, and I'm demanding that you externalize the hierarchy. Who?
You mean
who
is what individual?
Who is ultimately responsible for what I just, the charges that I just brought up?
Well, I mean, it starts with who was in charge at the time, and obviously that was LBJ, and you know, his defense secretary, Robert Strange McNamara, and whatever other types were involved in these decisions to put the clamp
on. Do you know
on.
What their genealogies are, sir?
Say again?
Have you studied their genealogies at all? I suggest that you do, and you might get
Johnson,
a little bit closer
Johnson
to the answer.
Was a Jew on his mother's side.
Well, that's a definitive Jew.
What's that?
That is definitively a Jew. That is not Jewish descent.
Yes, that's right. And McNamara, I would imagine he's an Irish-American. I don't know.
Have you studied the history of the Jews in Ireland? Have you studied the McNamara clan?
Oh, do you have any light to shed on that?
I just suggest that you take a look at the man's genealogy and you take a look at the subject line, the history of the Jews in Ireland.
You know, I don't think that is significant to the point where the Liberty story needs to be told and this particular group of Jews was having an undue influence on the United States government. If they were Martians or Brazilians or Mexicans or Chinese, whoever they are, they should not be able to flex their muscle with our government. Our government should be able to withstand their pressure. So
well, that's self-evident. But honestly, do you think that Jewish control and influence over American politics and American policy has increased or decreased since June 8, 1967?
Dramatically increased.
Okay, so regardless of your intent, what you're saying is misdirection. Let's get to the bottom of this. Who is responsible then? Who is responsible now for pro-Israel, anti-American activity on the part of the American military? Who? Who controls it?
Well, the people who were around back then are no longer around, right?
Who's doing it now? We have a Jewish president now. No one ever mentions this.
Well, you know, this is something that obviously is an important topic, but for this show, we're going to focus more on the historical aspects of the Liberty, and I'd like to learn as much as I can about everything, but I agree with you that it is important. We have to find out who's pulling the strings, and we have to make sure that they don't do that anymore. And
how will you ensure that?
We don't know.
What do you intend to ensure?
We have to do what we can. And let me answer your other question after we get back from the break.
With you and me, we all can be heroes.
Cut short this bumper music so we can get to all of the callers, which is great because this show is for the listeners and for the callers, and so we're happy that you're calling in, and we love the interest in this topic that still, after almost 53 years, people are interested in it. Like the first caller we had, John in California, and now Bill in Florida. So, Bill, in reference,
yes, sir.
I believe your question was about the Israeli pilots, right? That you were saying,
correct,
that there might have been some dual U.S.-Israeli citizens who were piloting those planes. In reference to that, unfortunately, there's no evidence about that, although it is a possibility that that was the case, but there's zero evidence about that. I have personally communicated several times with the lead pilot, the Israeli lead pilot, who was piloting one of the Mirage jets who initially attacked the Liberty. And we went over a bunch of things. And that was brought up as well. And he kind of scoffed at me about that.
Now, and he speaks English.
Yes, he speaks English, yes.
Sure, he scoffed at you. The arrogance is palpable.
Yeah,
I just want accountability. I want revelation of the method, but more than that, I want externalization of the hierarchy. We're going on 55, 54 years, whatever it is, it's 53 now, I guess, we're coming up on. It's too long. Because ever since that day, we've been fighting undeclared, unconstitutional massacres of aggression on behalf of the Rothschild state. And a lot of people, like me, think it needed to stop about 50 years ago.
You're not going to get any argument out of me or Al. You're 100% right. And I will never, ever disagree with what you just said, and I'm with you, and you know, we need the accountability. We need to get this world back into some sort of normality, or bring it to some sort of normality where we don't have these psychopaths doing what they're doing and murdering and drinking the blood of innocent people around the world every day. You're 100% right, and I appreciate you bringing these points to my attention, to Al's attention, and to the audience's attention.
Very briefly, I have a method.
Yes.
You need very few things to bring these people to justice. You need names and addresses. You need the Magna Carta. You need the Declaration of Independence. You need the Fifth and especially the Seventh Amendment, the preamble to the Bill of Rights, and you need common law grand jury rules. Now, we can't execute these people, and we can't incarcerate them, but we can strip them and their families of every shred of clothing and every bit of their wealth. And that is the method. Period. Paragraph.
Yeah, well, you might be right, Bill, but...
I know I'm right.
Well, let's keep fighting, my friend.
If the Constitution is no longer in force owing to Public Law 102-14, then the rubber has now hit the road.
Well, thank you again, Bill. I appreciate it. We're going to get to the next caller. Thank you, Bill. Before we get to Chance in West Virginia, I want to ask Al about this because you didn't get a chance to. You were on board. Bill, the caller in Florida, was wondering why it is that Captain McGonagall got a higher medal than Commander Armstrong. Can you add some insight into that?
Well, during the attack, Commander Armstrong, after we got hit with a napalm bomb on the port side of the ship near the gasoline storage barrels, he formed up a fire party. And he went out to form it up, and rockets hit, and he got hit. And they dragged him inside the pilot house. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, one leg was just holding on by a little bit of skin, and he died. Well, Captain McGonagall got hit with shrapnel, but he stayed on the bridge, and he got weak at one time, and then he got composed, and we got a tourniquet on him and everything so his leg would stop bleeding, he stayed on the bridge. Captain McGonagall had steered the ship away from the five torpedoes to the extent that only one hit. So that was pretty remarkable. And the fact that he stayed up all night, navigated by the stars, and this, I was on the bridge, witnessed it with my own eyes. And so I think it's justifiable that the captain received the Medal of Honor. I think also the chief engineer, Lieutenant Golden, was probably equally deserving for keeping the power plants going as much as he did.
Okay, folks, you hear the music? We'll be back. Al, I want to ask you another question about that military museum when we get back.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for listening, and thank you for calling in. Yes, so Al, we were talking about Lieutenant Golden, you were saying, is someone who
might he could have very well have been a recipient of the Medal of Honor because of his ability to take over in engineering. I think there was one person who stayed down there when they announced that a torpedo was headed for the ship, and he run everybody out of there, but the one person... I don't know if it was the chief or whatever. He said, I'm not leaving you. And it might have been Chief Brooks.
Right.
And then Doc Kiefer. This guy was up all night long. He was doing operations, you know, surgery and everything, and taking care of everybody he could take care of. And at one time, he had to take care of himself because he had shrapnel in his gut.
How did he do that?
He went someplace where nobody else saw him, and he stitched himself up and put on a bandage and then put the life vest of Mae West over him. It was like a Mae West. I'm not sure it was actually a Mae West. And he continued on.
He put the life vest on to hold his guts in, basically.
To cover up the bandage so they couldn't see that any blood or anything.
Right.
He didn't want anybody to know that he was injured.
Right. Right. And getting back to Commander Armstrong, who Bill was talking about, there's a museum in Frankenmuth, Michigan, your home state, called the Military and Space Museum. And there's a Liberty display there?
Commander Armstrong, his uniform and other items of his are on display there. I also put a blue working jacket with a Liberty patch onto it. That is there, and they bring it out once in a while, but, you know, they got a lot of stuff in rotation. But Commander Armstrong, the best that I know of, pretty much stays out there most of the time.
So he's honored pretty well in that military.
Very well.
Yep. Okay. Thank you, Al. Appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's get to, if we could, Chance in West Virginia. Chance, are you out there?
Yes, hello, Dave. Hello, Mr. Easton. You know, that caller, Bill, made some excellent points. Did you know that Jared and Ivanka Kushner are both practicing Shabbat Lubavitchers? Did you know that?
I mean, I know that he's Jewish, and she became a Jew, if that's possible.
Yep, Shabbat Lubavitchers. They're Shabbat Lubavitchers, you know, followers of the old Rabbi Schneerson.
Yes.
Okay, the question I have, Mr. Easton, sir, I don't suppose this present MIGA, that's Make Israel Great Again president, ever acknowledged the survivors or invited them to the White House?
That I know of.
Yep, that's exactly what I figured. That's par for his course. That tells me a lot about him. Well, sir, I know it sounds old, but thank you for your service. You're a hero in my eyes. And Dave, God bless you now.
Sir.
And thank you very much, Chance. I appreciate the call, and I appreciate you. And let's go to John in California. I'm sorry about that. Yes, you know how these calls can go on for a little while, but I never like to rush people off. How about we got a lot of Johns? All right, what's going on here? We had a. Okay, how dare those Johns just disappear? Okay, Jerry, how are you, my friend?
Hello, and thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, what if there happened to the movie that was 3-4 years ago?
Yes, movies don't just crop up overnight, and they require a lot of work. And the first draft of the screenplay is done, and the second draft is being worked on right now. And then this year should see some serious funding taking place with the movie. So this should be a good year. Of course, this ridiculous coronavirus got in the way and is getting in the way of a lot of things. But the movie is obviously something that is going to happen. It's just that it takes time to do such a really large, incredibly large project.
Okay, because I thought the idea was to get it out for the 50th anniversary of the Liberty.
Yeah, that would have been probably too aggressive of a goal, considering that the trailer, the donation trailer, was shot the year before. So that would have been nice, but no, there's just too many things. There's too many moving parts. Too much has to happen.
Okay, and one other question. How's Phil Turney doing?
Phil is doing good. He's doing fine. I just talked to him the other day, and he's in good health. And, you know, this is a tough time for most of the survivors. A lot of them have a difficult time handling the anniversary of the massacre, but he's doing fine.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time and what you've been doing.
Well, thank you, Jerry. Appreciate the call.
Okay.
Okay, we've got Charles in Florida. Go ahead, Charles.
Hello? Am I coming in?
Coming in loud.
Hello?
And clear. Yes, you're coming in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd like to say about talking about people, the Navy, that were prominent at that time. Are you familiar with that McCain's father, who was, I think, Admiral of the Pacific Fleet, and him were both didn't resign after the USS Liberty was attacked, whereas Admiral Morrison, you know, Jim Morrison's father, the Doors, you know, his father immediately resigned when that occurred. He gave up his commission in the Navy. One of my rear admiral friends I knew back then, who's deceased now in Annapolis, I used to live around then, he described the tribe's control of the Navy. He told me and my mother in 1958, I was about 13 years old. And he said, I warned you, you're not probably not going to believe. And I said, yeah, I believe you. I used, when I was 5 years old, I knew what you are telling me now. And he was very angry. He was a rear admiral we knew in Annapolis. My brother knew him real. But he described how Rickover never had to retire. Admiral Rickover didn't have to take a desk job like he had. You know, he was a rear admiral, and there were no active commissions. Rickover was allowed to stay in forever by his connections, the Jewish lobby in Congress. So there are at least four examples of people prominent in the Navy. There were one that was patriotic enough, Admiral Morrison, to quit, and three others that didn't care. Rickover was still in active service after 67 for several decades, as I'm aware of.
So the story of Jim Morrison's dad is that at the time of the Liberty Massacre, he was promoted to Rear Admiral, and then an article in a British newspaper, The Telegraph, reported that Morrison, it says here, vehemently opposed the U.S. response to and findings of the USS Liberty incident, which exonerated Israel of malice, and Morrison did not rise in rank again after his outspoken criticism of Israeli intentions. And he retired from the Navy in August of 1975. So he retired. He was stayed in the Navy for an additional 8 years plus after the Liberty Massacre. So he was still in the Navy, although he did not reach a higher rank. And I don't know for sure if that was because of the Liberty. There's really not much on Morrison saying anything about the Liberty that I have uncovered, or if it was because of his son, the attention that his son brought on him, or if it was because of some other things. Rickover, who was the father of the nuclear Navy, which I was in the nuclear Navy, he was, I believe, forced out of the Navy. So he was a very outspoken fella. He was Jewish, you're right. But they actually got rid of him. So you can read about his forced retirement. So they forced him out. So I hope that answers your questions that you.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yes. Yes, Charles. Thank you. Appreciate it. Let's stay in Florida. And we got John back with us. Oh. And John, sorry that we took so long to get to your call, which was actually you called, almost an hour ago. And see that? You know, 8 minutes short of it. John, how are you, my friend? I don't know if this
I'm
is
okay.
the John.
I think it
is. John,
I really
John, is it you?
Huh?
Is it John? Is it the John I'm thinking of?
John Conroy, Brooksville,
yes.
Florida.
Yes.
USS Davis.
All right, John. I have a surprise for you. And
I want to tell you, Dave, I've been listening to your broadcast that you called me this morning, and it's just amazing, amazing, amazing.
Thank you, John. And you're an amazing guy because you have an amazing connection to the Liberty. And
oh,
you
I
have
certainly
a connection to the fellow who's sitting here right next to me, and he's spoken very highly of you, which you were not aware of course. But we're going to get to that. But why don't you, for the benefit of the listeners, John, if you don't mind, explain to them, you know, a little bit about who you are, where you were born, when you went into the Navy, what you did in the Navy, and your connection to the Liberty.
Okay, I come from Leominster, Massachusetts. I went in the Navy back in 1955. And when I was 1967, I was a first-class personnelman on the USS Davis, which was a destroyer, 937, now long gone. But we were detailed to come to the assistance of the Liberty early in the morning following the attack. And as it was, I was detailed by my executive officer to go aboard the boarding party and accompany the photography team from Naples. But when we got on board, they had forgot their film, so being a personnelman, I went up to the ship's office to see what I could do to help. And everybody except for one sailor, I forget his name now, was either wounded or killed from the ship's office. And there was some ensign in there trying to put lists together. And it was a mess. So I said, let me stay in the ship's office and help straighten this all out. So I spent 6 days on the Liberty doing a lot of casualty reporting and then helped out a little bit down in the security spaces when they were shoring up the bulkhead. But anyhow, I went in the Navy in 55, retired after 30 years in 85. And my story about the Liberty I've been carrying around all these years, and I would tell it to anybody who would listen, but not very many people were interested in it. It's sad because it was a horrible, horrible thing to see.
Thank you, John. Well, that guy who you couldn't remember his name is the guy who's sitting right here.
God, that right. Back then, I remember he was just a young fellow. He was just a young kid. When I walked into the ship's office, he was sitting way in the back by himself. And, oh, my God. And I saw him there by himself, and he was, of course, he was in shock almost. And so I went to work from there, and he helped me a little bit, as I recall. But, my God, that's amazing. Amazing.
I was the seaman yeoman striker, 20 years old, and didn't really know a lot about casualty reporting or any of that. And
that's
I was
correct.
Blown away. You come in, you took charge, you sat down at that typewriter, and you hammered away, and you hammered away, and you hammered away. And I said,
36
this
hours.
Guy is a blessing to us because everybody else was gone. I was the only one left in the office. The other ones were wounded. And I couldn't believe you could be so knowledgeable about, I got to do this, I got to do that, I need this, I need that. And I tried to help out the best I could, and you probably found more stuff by accident than what I helped you.
Well, we got the job done. That's all that mattered. And I can remember going on the bridge and seeing Captain McGonagall up there and the doc trying to take care of him. And then we eventually, myself and our corpsman from the Davis, and a couple other people who actually helped Captain McDonald on his gurney, and we took him down to his stateroom. And I continued working in the ship's office, and then when I was done all my work there, I went down to the security spaces where the guys were working with the ship's crew and shoring up the bulkhead down there on the other side of the security spaces so the bulkhead wouldn't give way. If the bulkhead had given way, the ship would have gone down because it was an old World War II victory ship that only had two watertight bulkheads, one forward of the engine room, one after the engine room. And fortunately, the torpedo that did strike the ship and blow up in there went in at the waterline just above the forward watertight bulkhead, and the bulkhead saved the ship from sinking, along with the crew that did all the work to save that ship. It was amazing.
Yeah, well, if they would have hit the engine spaces, we'd have been lost.
Oh, yeah, you'd have gone down. You'd have gone down. You'd have pulled it right half and gone down.
Yeah, we'd have broken half. We'd have went down. And unfortunately, it took out about 25 communication technicians in research.
Yeah, yeah. But the crew of the Liberty, the damage control people on the crew of the Liberty, plus the crewmen from the Davis who went along. We actually tied up right next to the ship and offloaded a lot of.
Want to hang on till after the break?
Yeah, sure. I'm sitting here in the kitchen listening to this broadcast.
We're back. Thanks for staying with us to hear about the USS Liberty. This is a great story. John, you still out there?
I'm right here.
Yeah. So it's so cool because you and I'm just thankful your name isn't John. You got nothing but John's calling. I'm serious. We've got a John in Michigan who's next, and then we've got a John in New York. All right.
I'm kidding about
the Johns. That is true. It's been almost nothing but Johns today. But it's cool that you guys have not talked to each other in almost 53 years, number one. Number two is, John, you didn't know that Alan was the guy. Alan remembered
you.
Yes.
Oh, Dave, that's amazing. You know, all the years I've looked at my cruise book and look at the pictures, and I've got a photograph of him sitting in that office when I walked in. And I didn't know that was him. My God, this is absolutely amazing. Yeah, he was just a young fellow then, and he was the only survivor from the ship's office. It was up and moving around. I think one of the yeomen got killed up on the bridge.
I'm amazed that you got a photograph of me. I'm equally amazed that I'm talking to you 50 years later, and you're still alive, and so am I, because a lot's probably transpired in each of our lives. But you, you're the man. Yeah, you obviously are one of the incredible people in the military that pushes on and gets things done, and it's the kind of leadership that the Navy, the Army, the Marine Corps, and everything else needs in order to keep things going.
Well, you're exactly right, and I treasured all my years in the Navy. I'm 82 now, pushing 83. I retired back in 85, and that's another life story. But the Liberty incident has been in my heart and my mind all these years, and I would tell the story about the Liberty and the rescue we went through when we boarded the Liberty to anybody who would listen, but not very many people either heard about it or cared to hear about it, so I kept it bottled up all these years until I met Dave. I haven't met him personally, but we've talked. Well, Dave, you came down here once, did you?
Well, I did, except we couldn't meet because of this ridiculous virus. You know, we were planning on it, but we're going to do it.
Long before, with a camera.
What's that, John?
Didn't you come down to my house here in Brooksville and we talked and you took some pictures or whatever? Didn't we do that?
No, we didn't.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Mixed up.
When was that?
Oh, goodness gosh. Well, a couple of years ago?
No, that wasn't me. We were supposed to meet in March, but the virus took care of that.
Yeah, I was ready. I was.
So was I.
Bob Evans Restaurant, as I remember.
That's it, exactly. So we're going to do it. Alan, go ahead.
Okay.
I'm about 10 years junior, John. And the other thing that's significant about the Liberty incident is I got out in December of 67, having done 3 years, 2 months, and I think 3 years, 3 months or 2 months and 2 weeks. And I stayed out 4.5 years, and I come back in as a reservist, and my first duty station coming back in was none other than USS Papago ATF-160, which met up with Liberty in the middle of the night and towed a platform with lighting and fished debris and even one body.
That was the tug that followed us and fished those divers that went out the hole. There were guys that died and went out the hole on the side of the ship.
We got a break. We'll be back in a bit. Okay. Friend, we're going to have to get to the next caller, but it's always a pleasure. Al, did you want to say something to John before we?
Yeah, when I come back in the Navy 4.5 years later, I went to the USS Papago, which was directly responsible for retrieving at least one body and a lot of material that come out of the torpedo hole and later that night after the day of the attack. But it's really been a pleasure to talk to you and meet you, and I hope you stay healthy and live a lot longer, John.
Well, same to you, and thank you very much for sharing your stories with us. I'm so glad I can talk to people who been through that, were there, and understood understood the tragedy that occurred on that ship. I've never forgotten it all these years, and I can talk for hours about what I saw, what I did, what I learned, what I heard, and debunk a lot of crap that's been put out about this whole thing, if someone will listen. And Dave listens.
I do. I do. Well, thank you, John. Thanks for calling in, and hopefully we'll see you soon, my friend.
Thank you again, okay. John, for talking to you.
In touch.
Thanks, John.
All right.
Thank you, John. That was great. Okay, so let's go to another John. This is John in Michigan. John, is that your first name or your middle name?
No, it's my first name.
Great. Okay. Great. Yep. All right.
Hello, gentlemen. I was just wondering, what was the mission of the ship at that time, and what was, and how long had you been in those waters before it happened? Can you talk to that or no?
It was only a matter of I think 5 days or so that we passed through the Straits of Gibraltar. We stopped off at Rota, Spain, and took on some supplies and some people come aboard. I think we got a Marine detachment came aboard. There was three people and some civilians. I don't know how many civilians.
Actually, it was nine. It was three Marines, three civilians, and three CTs.
Oh, okay.
But that's something that has been shrouded in mystery.
Yeah. But anyway, we were steaming off the 13 miles off the Sinai Peninsula, and it was blistering hot there. But Captain McGonagall had the intelligence to keep everybody drilling at general quarters every day. And we were really put out with it. But you know what? I think that's the reason I'm alive today. You can't be too prepared. And we would never have suspected that our allies would have attacked us.
Yeah. And in reference to your question about what their mission was, the closest I could get to finding out about that was what the head of the research department said. And it wasn't a very specific, command. It was, find out, and I'm not kidding. He said, find out who's doing what to whom, something like that. And that was how technical the direction was. So they were just there to pick up signals, communication.
In lay terms, it's just monitoring whatever signals are in the air, and if it's coded or encrypted, to try to decode it, and if it wasn't decodable, they forward it on to NSA in the States and let them deal with it.
And would that be like telephone transmissions, or would it be regular military equipment that like, let's say, Israel had, or Egypt had, or Jordan?
I'm not going to say what it was. I can tell you that I know we were monitoring communications. We had a transmission apparatus called Treshcom on the after deck house that could bounce signals off the moon and get messages sent out in a matter of an hour or two that usually took 23 hours. And you got to know one thing. If you ever go out and start listening to stuff, there are so many signals from so many different countries and so many different people that it's hard to sort it out. And so that was a full-time job, just sorting out what was up there between what might be beneficial and what might not matter at all.
Now, was that all on tape reel at the time, or no?
Was that what now?
Was that being recorded on like tape reel, or however they did it way back then, or and were those tapes destroyed?
I would say there's a good chance it might have been on some kind of tape reel, but I couldn't tell you for sure.
And I did hear something about about some tapes being destroyed, but I don't know for sure. But if you know, if the power of you know, Israel is something that is accurate, then yes, it probably was destroyed. Yeah, they don't want this. They do not want this story obviously getting out to anyone.
Right.
And the fact that there are, and this is something that's overlooked, is that, and the only reason that I'm aware of it is because I had the honor to speak with all of these guys and other people about this, but the fact that there are so many U.S. Israeli dual citizens in Israel actually nominally, not that they, I don't know if they honor it, because it seems like they certainly don't honor what the Constitution says when it comes to us, but would put the United States in a difficult position to monitor communications in Israel, because if an individual was an Israeli, but he or she was also a U.S. citizen, that would preclude the government, the U.S. government, from listening in without a warrant on their communications.
Huh.
So
yeah,
the fact that
it's tragic.
There are, yes, very much, that there are so many dual U.S. citizens, it actually provides them constitutional protection from being monitored. So they actually even have that in their back pocket that protects them from our own country making sure that they are not stabbing us in the back.
Right. Yeah, you know what? I'll bet you a lot of them have not only dual citizen, they probably got triple citizenship, quadruple citizenships with all of the West. You know what I mean? They're all infiltrated, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's terrible, man. I feel for you guys. But thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
All right, nice talking to you.
Thank you, John. Thanks for being our last guest.
Thank you.
All right. We got Murr in Wisconsin. Murr, you out there?
Hi.
Murr? Hi, what's on your mind?
You let me jump the line. Thank you. I told Ken you need a Mary. Too many Johns.
Oh, no. You're...
The what? M stands for.
I'm sorry. You know what? That's my fault. I apologize.
Huh? What for?
I messed up. You know why? I'm seeing there's like a million Johns on the screen. And, Murr, would you mind if we get to that other John before you? let me get John in New York first, and then we'll come back to you, Murr, okay?
That's fine. Thank you.
Hold on a second. Ken, if you could bring John in New York on, because I messed up, because all those Johns, I'm like, literally, right. There's just nothing but Johns on the screen here. So, John in New York, you out there?
You got a lot of Johns and one lady named Murr. Thanks for the...
John, I'm sorry that I probably did it, you know, subconsciously. You know, I had enough of Johns, so...
I know, it's hard to keep track.
Nothing against you. What's on your mind, John?
Well, I've been involved with some of the events that have gone on in the Middle East. I have a USS Liberty, hat and T-shirt. There was a gentleman. I kind of tuned in late, and I'm grateful that Republic Broadcasting is carrying this. I've heard a gentleman from Missouri give a talk in Albany about events that transpired from his perspective. And it was so validating, because reading history and listening to somebody who lived the history is a big difference. You can hear it in the tonality of a person's speech. And it's been a lot of Navy guys calling from my perspective. And it's good to hear the insider Navy orientation. Now, my concern is that, to keep the story alive, because we live in an age of, you know, it's almost like Fahrenheit 451, news and history disappear. I believe you, the topic about the father of John McCain, Admiral McCain, wasn't he part of the cover-up of the event? That's one point. Second point is, why has the Navy, is there a Navy, who represents the sailors within the Navy? Do the sailors have a professional voice? I believe that there have been meetings where finally the Liberty was acknowledged. That was a breakthrough moment within the last 20 years. That's significant. And so that's a point that I wanted to make. And the third point is, was this a false flag? Now, Johnson was pretty cold from reports that I've seen in his interactions, and it almost seemed like he wanted the ship to go down. Was this a backup story? I mean, did the President of the United States want that ship to go down, in your opinion?
Okay, so the first question is about Admiral McCain. There's no evidence that he was involved in a cover-up, other than he instructed Admiral Kidd to conduct the Court of Inquiry, which the Court of Inquiry was, the purpose of the Court of Inquiry wasn't to uncover what Israel did to the Liberty. The purpose of the Court of Inquiry was to uncover if the Liberty followed naval protocol. It wasn't to find any, or it wasn't to investigate any guilt on the side of Israel. What did Israel do? Even though Admiral Kidd asked the crew members to recount what they witnessed, that wasn't its purpose. It was convened quickly, and it was resolved quickly. So that was due to, clearly that was due to Israeli pressure. But that was the extent of Admiral McCain's involvement in it. Do the sailors have, like, a union, you mean, or any somebody representing them? Al, you were in the Navy for over two decades. I guess you could answer that question.
A little over 22 years, and I can tell you it all rests on the chain of command. Okay, and it goes up to your admirals, and then it goes on up to Secretary of State, and then it goes up to the President. So the blame always goes to the top. Now, whether it went to the President as being the blame, I don't think so. But I think that all they did, they managed to exonerate the Liberty from being at fault. They did not incite it. They did not bring it upon themselves. They were not within the jurisdiction of the Israelis' boundaries.
Do sailors have a union or representation?
No union.
Yeah, so does anybody look out for the sailors' interests?
No. Well, your president is the one that's going to protect you.
Supposed to.
If the commander-in-chief can't be trusted, who can be trusted?
Right. And in reference to the false flag question, that's something that is part of the mythology, I think, of the Liberty story, because you hear about, you know, Johnson said that he wants to see that ship at the bottom of the GDC or ocean, whatever, you know, whatever is said, you know, relayed about what he said. But there's a couple of things here. The first point about it being a false flag, why it doesn't make sense, is because if the purpose of attacking the Liberty and sinking the Liberty was to draw the United States into the war on Israel's side against Egypt or whatever Arab country, the reason that doesn't make sense is because the war was over. So Israel, as you know, we talked about earlier, had decimated the Arab forces because it was preemptive and it was planned, and they had their spies infested in those countries. They knew what to do and where to hit. So there was no war. There was no war for the U.S. to join on a particular side of. Another reason why that wouldn't make sense is because, remember, this is the time of the Cold War, and because of Israel's decisions that they made to attack preemptively at that time, we had a situation where the Soviet Union was threatening Israel and threatening the United States that if Israel tried to go into Syria, that they would meet them militarily. It got to the point where the Soviet Union got permission from Tito's Yugoslavia to get landing rights at an airport in Yugoslavia to send paratroopers to meet the Israelis in between Damascus and Tel Aviv. So we got very close to a very serious conflagration because of Israel and their rash decisions, which is one of the reasons that Israel is not an ally of the United States, and they never wanted to be an ally of the United States. They're not an ally now. They're not an ally now, even though a lot of people call them an ally. They're not, because there's never been a mutual defense pact or treaty signed between the two countries, because if there was, then when Israel wanted to do something like, let's say, massacre innocent civilians, they'd have to let their ally know, hey, we're going to go into this area. And then their ally might say, whoa, hold on a second, that's not a smart idea. If you do that, then we're going to have to deal with the fallout here. It's going to endanger our position here. And then Israel would have to listen to the United States. But what they do is, instead of becoming an ally, they just do what they want, and then they deal with the consequences. Besides, they own the U.S. Congress anyway, including the executive. So the false flag idea doesn't make any sense because there was just too many things happening at the time, besides the fact that the war was over, that it wouldn't make sense for the United States to join a war that was over to do something that makes no sense that they would do. Although pretty much everybody hated Nasser, including the Soviet Union, even though that was their client state, because Nasser wasn't pro-Soviet enough. The United States didn't care for Nasser, but there were overtures that were made by earlier than the 67 war by the Arabists and the State Department to try to woo Nasser, but he opted to align himself more closely with the Soviet Union, but they didn't care for him. Everybody wanted Nasser out except for the Egyptian people, because he was a loved figure by many, and he was a populist, and he cared about his people. But it doesn't make sense for the false flag story to be propagated. And the other matter is that when, actually, I think we might have, are we still on, or?
Yeah.
Are we? Oh, good.
I don't know.
What's that? Sorry?
Is the show still on?
We're still going? We're not on commercial, right? Okay, good. Okay. And, you know, because I thought we were on a commercial break. I just looked at the time. And if we need to take a break, let's take a break and we'll come back to it. Okay, and then we'll come back. Be right back.
It starts with you and me.
We're back. Thank you for tuning in to this special broadcast on Deanna Spingola's show about the USS Liberty. And the last part of the false flag is, you know, Johnson you know, saying, oh, I want that ship on the bottom of the GDC. Well, I was able to interview two people. One of them was the fellow on the Liberty who was in charge of the research department, who was called into the admiral's cabin on the America after they brought the wounded aboard and the murdered. And he told him what happened because he was the one who, you know, heard Washington say to pull those planes back, that, you know, they had to come back the planes, instead of going to the aid of the Liberty. And that happened twice. And, you know, the second time it happened, the admiral asked for higher authority, which above the Secretary of Defense was the president. And the president said, you know, to get the planes back. But he didn't say, and this was corroborated by two sources, he didn't say, I want that ship on the bottom of the sea. He said, you know, get the planes back. I will not embarrass an ally over a few dead sailors. And of course, this was juxtaposed against all of the body bags coming back from Vietnam. And they did think it was a few dead sailors at the time. So the planes most likely never would have reached the Liberty. Probably virtually impossible for them to reach the Liberty from where they were at before the torpedo hit. That's another point. So Johnson did mention ally. He didn't mention Israel, but he did mention ally. So I hope that answers your question, John.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And have you made any contacts with Allison Weir?
I know Allison Weir, and she's done some great work. But there isn't, at this point, anything that she could add to what I have garnered about the Liberty.
Certainly. Well, thank you very much, and God bless all the survivors.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Okay, now we're going to go to Murr in Wisconsin. Murr, sorry about that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you know, when you, I guess it was 2 years ago, you and Phil were on for Deanna, and I asked Phil if he thought there was divine intervention, and he said, he described in some detail how it couldn't be anything else that kept that boat afloat, you know, and several other things. So we have to remember who's in charge. But, you know, just 3 years ago, on the 50th anniversary, underreported and misreported and not reported at all, when President Trump spoke in Warsaw, Poland, he first sent a listening ship, much like the Liberty, to Israel on just about the 50th anniversary. And then in July, before he went, he sent the USS GHW Bush warship, the largest warship in the world, and left it off the coast of Israel. And Israel News tried to play it up as, you know, peacekeeping and blah, blah, blah. No, this was to keep them from pulling anything while he was in Warsaw. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes, you know, and that people will complain about the embassy moving to Jerusalem. Well, he put it off and put it off. And, you know, they would keep this, the Jews keep this over every president like a sword of Damocles. And so he finally said, okay, but use what's there. So it's appeasing, kind of. And this is what has to be done. They run the money and they run the propaganda. And until perhaps it'll take bringing everything down to ground zero to start again without usury. You know, there was This man that said, I found it extremely difficult myself to be a match for the dialectical perfidy of that race. How futile it was to try to win over such people with argument, seeing that their very mouths distorted the truth, disowning the very words they had just uttered and adopting them again in a few moments later to serve their own ends in the argument. In other words, They just lie and re-lie, and they do this over and over, and they don't care who it hurts, and they don't even care if it's some of the room. And I don't know if you can guess who that was. That was the Chancellor of Germany that took his people into usury free for as long as they could. And we don't hear about that being reported either, and they were Christian. And that is why we have the Jews investing how much money into making all these movies to tell the truth? No. To entertain us because they love us? No. And speaking of the movie, I think, I got several books from you, and I'm really enjoying them. And some of that money went towards the movie. So I don't know, is there any progress on that? And I know True News was going to do something, too.
Thank you, Murph. And you're right. You know, they have their media and their movies to maintain their narrative. So we don't have any chance to question anything.
But we do have information otherwise behind the scenes, and we need to use that. People like to poo-poo this cue, but there's information there, and it's being shared worldwide. So just because Talmudia tells you not to listen to it, listen anyway. I'll get off so the others can get on. Thank you.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. Thanks. We're going to come back, and I'll answer your question about the movie when we get back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and
Oops,
me.
We're back.
We are.
All right. Murr, are you still on, or are you?
I am.
Oh, good. Okay. Yes. Yes, the movie is still moving forward. We're working on the second draft of the script. And I hope that today, when they start to, or not today, I hope that this year, when they start to resume, some sort of, normal functioning after this ridiculous virus overreaction.
Absurdity.
Thing, ridiculous operation that they did, an insult to all of us, then
Lloyd
I can
is
begin
too.
To hit the ground and talk to people. The funding of the film, which was the plan all along. But the script has to be in order because that's the blueprint of any movie is the script. And in reference to, well, and thank you for saying what you said about the books, that you enjoyed them. Appreciate that. And in reference to True News, last May of 2019, I put together that event for True News. With Phil selected the survivors to take part in it and coordinated getting them all there and picking them up at the airport. And I drove from where I am in the panhandle and assisted True News in pulling that all together. And that's going to be a documentary. Which something
long drive.
I don't know if something's going to air Monday. Or it was supposed to happen last year, but it didn't. Two parts did air. I was on one of them, and the other survivors that Phil and I selected were on that other part. Mm-hmm. Of course, True News has lost its YouTube channel, I think. But again, this will be a documentary. What we're working on is an actual film, a docudrama, which will be a full-length feature film. Not have any of the survivors in it, but have actors who will be portraying the survivor, and of course it will be a true story.
Well, you know, too, with True News, you go right to their site, and it's very good visibility and audio. I think that is a very good thing. Everyone needs to break away from this YouTube.
Absolutely, 100%.
It's another Jew-controlled operation.
Absolutely.
Lyor Cohen, L-Y-O-R, only he makes the rappers that he ran. And controlled, and he wouldn't let them do anything positive. Call him Lior.
This is a poison. YouTube, right. Google, Facebook, Twitter. This is a poison that is poisoning the country. It's poisoning the First Amendment. The mainstream media is a poison. It needs to be destroyed.
Mudstream.
What is it?
Mudstream.
Mudstream, perfect. Unless and until...
Talmudstream is what I call it, but
that's right.
One of
unless
Dr. Paul's brothers called it.
We have no choice. And that's why
Listen,
Trump, no matter...
We need to call them out by name, each of them. Like, they go after us?
Absolutely.
We need to call each of them out by name.
Absolutely.
Speaking of which,
100%.
Last week, Michael Levitt came forward about this hoax, this hollow cough, and I'm calling it that.
Yes.
Yes, and... It's real great, but he's a Jew, and he's born in South Africa, and he's a, one of your callers, or Alan said, quadra citizen? Well, he's a, has quadra citizenship.
Yes.
You know, yes, who should have that? No one should have something like that.
No,
and no. And, of course, two of them are American, Israel, and South Africa, and where else?
Something needs to be done, obviously, and that's the really the purpose of the film is to apply the first chink in the armor. And
Byzantium took all the power away from them. Wouldn't let them handle money, government, or children. That is education.
That's right. You know? Absolutely.
We aren't the kind of people that teach sodomy in kindergarten like they are.
Absolutely. We know what the problem is. We have to neutralize the problem. And I think that's what we're all trying to do. And Murr, I appreciate your call. And it was great talking to you again. And thank you for listening to the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. All right. We have Donna in California. Donna, you out there?
Yes. Hello.
Oh, thank
you. I have a question.
Thank you for waiting so long. And please go ahead.
Yes, I have a question. Okay, there were 34 men that were killed, correct? On the USS Liberty?
34 were murdered, yes.
Murdered, okay, better word. Okay, these 34 men had families. What did the Navy say to them, how they got killed?
Well, what she did was...
What reason did they give them?
Yes, what they did was they sent out letters to the family members. One of them, for example, Jerry Lee Goss. Jerry Lee Goss had just turned 26 a week before he was murdered. He was a third-class petty officer, a communications technician, and he was at his station, his general quarters station, in the research spaces with the 24 other young men who were murdered when the torpedo hit the ship. And I'm reading this right from the book. It says, the officer who came to tell his parents about it, they paid a personal visit to Mr. and Mrs. Harry Goss in, I think it was Indiana. Let me see if I'm right. In North Vernon, I think that was Indiana. I could be wrong though. The officer told Mr. and Mrs. Harry Goss their son had drowned in a flooded compartment or his body was washed out to sea. Basically, he had no idea what happened to one of their five children. He told them that final information would be available after Liberty docked in Malta. A few weeks later, they received a promised telegram from the man responsible for covering up their son's murder, Lyndon Johnson. The telegram, stamped June 29, 1967, was brief and incredibly insulting to those who knew the truth. And the telegram says, Mr. and Mrs. Goss, I was deeply grieved to learn of the death of your son, Petty Officer Jerry Lee Goss, at sea. Words are inadequate to express my heartache in this tragedy. I want you to know that all our people share my pride in your son's service. His dedication contributed directly to maintaining the freedom our nation supports throughout the world. May God, in his infinite wisdom, bring comfort to you and your loved ones. Sincerely, Lyndon B. Johnson. This went to Mr. and Mrs. Harry Herschel Goss, 38 Oakwood Drive, North Vernon, Indiana. So that is how they were notified.
So a cover-up. Well,
I mean,
yeah, it's
how about that?
Despicable. You know, just totally despicable.
Absolutely.
You know, this tragedy that happened to the USS Liberty and the men who had to bear the burden all these years silently, it just affects them, but also this injustice was done to all of America, all American people.
That's right.
That they would just cover this up and
well, of course, because the government's working for us, right? They're supposed to.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We know. Well, don't be afraid. Just keep telling the truth.
Thank you, Donna. Thank you, Donna. Appreciate it. Okay, we've got Tom in Florida. Tom, thanks for holding on so long, and what can we help you with?
Yes, sir. Good day to you. Can you hear me? Hello?
Loud and clear.
Yeah, I want to say Murr made some really very, very excellent points, what she was saying, but let's get to the real point here. Let's get to the stuff, to the cut to the chase. First off, the white majority in this country better start taking its majority back. We cannot let the narrative be run by a bunch of left-wing Bolshevik communists, which is in a minority. I don't care who they are. You got a lot of white, I don't know what you want. You give the other word. I know what the word is. They're white. You know what? It starts with a T. In this country, are taking down our monuments, southern, northern, whatever monuments, even trying to vandalize the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. But, you know, I'm going to get to the Liberty in a minute. But before I do, I want you to know that George Floyd's already got $12 million on his GoFundMe page. You have you've had 19 whites killed by cops in 2019 now. You only had 9 blacks. We'll say 10 blacks, okay? Where's the GoFundMe pages for all these whites who were killed by cops? Where's the GoFundMe pages for Kate Steinle, who was killed by an illegal alien? All the 5,878 angel mothers and fathers families, where's their GoFundMe pages? How much is the federal government paying their families for having illegal aliens come to this country illegally, murdering these Americans, black and white? Where's the protest for that? Where's these protests for the girl Cinnamon Christian and Brian Newsom? You heard about that case in Knoxville, Tennessee? Has any of your callers?
That was horrible. Horrible.
Okay. Now, did anybody, the father, can you imagine what that father of Cinnamon Christian must be going through to this day? That happened in 2007.
No, you're right. You're right, and of course the reason is because the and this is my opinion, the Jews media, which is what I call it because that's what it is, the Jews media has successfully brainwashed at least one generation or more.
Sir, they're trying to brainwash my daughter right now. I have 3 daughters. Okay, they already brainwashed my youngest one. Okay. The other ones, I had to get them out of rap music back when they were listening to it. It's crap. It's militant. Let me tell you something. Rock and roll back in the 1950s, the 60s, the 70s, 80s, the 90s, 2000s, if any rock and roll band would have had any kind of filthy lyrics that these black rappers are getting away with, they would have never made it on major millions of dollars touring all over, making millions of dollars, making albums and doing tour dates, okay? But these people now, these kids nowadays are listening to crap music. That shit is banned. That's an anti-government. Okay, now listen, I'm going to get to the Liberty in a minute. I remember back in the 90s, there was a paper called the Spotlight Newspaper, and it had the Cato Institute. And I remember they used to run articles in that paper talking about the Liberty for years. It was called the Spotlight Newspaper. You ever heard of it?
Yeah, I used to write for American Free Press for about 10 years, and that was the successor to the Spotlight, yes.
Yes, do you remember back in those days, they were even predicting rioting, okay? I remember, and I'm not, the pandemic's itself, I'll give that for another show, because that what's going on with this Corona's holy hoax, COVID-19, yeah, there's probably something out there. But I tell you right now, what they did to this country is disgraceful and disgusting. And that Jared Kushner, he's in there with Trump. I don't trust him for nothing, that Kushner, the son-in-law of Trump. He's another bumbling buffoon. But, you know, getting back to what I'm very angry about, though, is what's going on with these white millennials, how brainwashed they are. And you know what? They had a video of Floyd now. They called him. Have you heard this latest? That they called him the landlord or something?
No.
Yeah, there's a video of him. He was doing a tape called the landlord.
Yeah. No, I haven't heard of that, but.
Yeah, well, this guy was, look, I mean, what the cops do is horrific, okay? And they all need to be persecuted to the full extent of the law. There's no question about that, okay? You're Oriental, and listen, you're not all white cops, okay? You got an Oriental, you got another guy looks like I don't know what he is, Middle Eastern, and then you have the two white cops. And one white cop told him, hey, man, get off the guy. And, you know, he was a rookie, so I think that guy's going to get off, that guy Lane. I think Lane's going to end up potentially getting off or reduced sentence because he was telling the senior cop, hey, man, what are you doing? Roll the guy over. So, you know, look, the media was looking for this. Look at CNN, MSLSD. You got Anderson Pooper, big-time homosexual, Rachel Maddow. 90% of the anchors in these multi-million-dollar jobs that are putting out spew about white Anglo and white culture are homosexuals.
Absolutely. I think we know who the enemy is, and we know what has to be done. I mean, I agree with you 100%. But go ahead and ask your question about the Liberty, Tom, because we got another caller.
Okay, I will. But real quickly, I just want to say before that ends, the majority's got a rule now. You know what? We start with I noticed all these Afro-Americans have big marches in Washington. When is it going to be 5-10 million white Anglos that get Christians fed up saying nothing?
Yeah,
not going to be pushed
around. I don't. That's the problem. I don't think it's going to happen. Because of the brainwashing. But go ahead, man. Tell me about the Liberty.
Okay, the Liberty. We all know that the Americans have a peace flag up on that ship. That ship should have never been targeted. I believe that was this target practice for the Israelis to test their air force or whatever. And you know what? Nobody's talking about this. You tell me, and I'm going to hang up right now. In 1945, the Nazi regime's in ruins, right? The United States won the war. Patton's taken over the Bavarian army. They made a movie with George C. Scott. We fought the wrong sons of bitches. He's saying, was telling all these leaders in Washington, Truman and all of them, let's turn and go against Russia right now. Watch the movie of George C. Scott, what he says at the end of the movie. Now, Patton's got a German army under his command, okay? He was murdered also. But here's the real thing about what's going on with Israel. How does Israel get an atomic bomb 17 years after 1945? Huh? You want to answer that, somebody? How did Israel get an atomic warhead in 1962 or 63?
Right. Well, they stole the material. They used their Jewish spies and around the world to do it.
Okay. Well, you remember the other Jew, Caspar Weinberger, when they caught Jeffrey Pollard. You remember what Caspar Weinberger said to Reagan?
Jonathan. He said, "Let me take." Yes. What did he say?
He said, "Let me take this guy out in front of the White House. I'll shoot him personally." That was a Jewish guy, Caspar Weinberger, saying that about Pollard.
Yes.
Caspar Weinberger, who is a great American, by the way. And
yes,
he said that about Pollard.
He told
Reagan, hey, man, this guy's the biggest treason. This guy has been the biggest treason in the history of our country.
Yes.
Nobody's ever talked about that. Pollard?
Yeah,
now
you're right.
And one more thing, and I'll let you go. You notice when the Israelis kill a bunch of Arabs over there? No, that's not in their mass media for weeks and weeks. Rioting them. You don't see the Arabs going around burning up the cities of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, do you?
No.
I guarantee you in Cuba, these people wouldn't be protesting burning up Havana or Matanzas or any of these other cities in Cuba or China or Venezuela. They shoot them all.
Man.
All the protesters. They would. Only in this country can they get away with this. In England, what you see what's going on in London right now is disgusting, too.
Matter of fact, you're right, Tom.
They had a bunch of whites get stabbed to death in England, and nobody's protesting those white British who are native to the land there, and they brought all these Muslims in there, and they're stabbing these white people to death over in England, and nobody's protesting that. Where's their GoFundMe pages?
Exactly, and the whites are backing up the invaders. You're right, Tom. You're right. Well, thank you, Tom. Appreciate the call. Okay, we're going to go to someone who I know and care about, and that is the wife of a fella who is known as Yellowstone Bob. Are you out there?
Hi, Dave.
I am here.
Hi, Dave.
How are you doing?
I'm okay, getting... Well, not great. It's hard to be married to a man for 47 years and lose him, you know.
Yes, yes.
It's very hard. I want to thank you guys for the flowers that you sent to the funeral.
Oh, of course.
And the books that you sent out to people who donated. I know they got passed around.
Well, thank you.
In fact,
thank
I know that some of the books got passed around the Great Lakes, and Great Lakes, you know, so
yes.
I think the books are getting out.
Yes, well, thank you. That was your husband, Robert Thomas Erpelding, Michigan native, listed in the Navy in 1966 at the age of 18, and was serving as a deckhand aboard USS Yellowstone, AD 27. And, of course, you, Laura, said to him, did you ever know about the USS Liberty? And Bob said no. And then you told him a little bit about what you had heard, and that you guys were in the med at the same time. And then the bell went off in his head, and he said something's going on there. And the Yellowstone was nicknamed the Queen of the Tenders, and this is an unknown story about the Liberty, named after Yellowstone National Park. And what happened was that, as Bob recalled, the Yellowstone was in Malta, scheduled to go to Naples after. And then word was passed that they were going to get underway immediately. Yellowstone got underway immediately, going flank about 14 knots. And Bob says it was his understanding that they got about 10 to 15 miles from the Liberty, and they told the Yellowstone to shut down and turn around. And Bob said, we didn't think of it at the time, but we didn't go back to Malta. We went to Naples. He said, I never thought about it. I served on a couple of ships afterward. He said, knowing the Navy and the way the government works, they sent us back to Naples because Liberty was coming to Malta and they didn't want us to see it. So the Queen of the Tenders was just a few nautical miles away and could have provided much-needed aid for the Liberty, but the U.S. government ordered the Yellowstone to steam away from the Liberty instead of rushing toward the Liberty, forcing the Liberty to wait almost a full day for help to arrive. So because of you, Laura, Bob's story is known now to many people, and I know myself and Phil and the fellow sitting next to me, Alan Easton, who was aboard the Liberty, really appreciate that. And Al,
absolutely,
yes,
absolutely.
And Laura was the one who,
because you put it in the book. I think he won't ever die. Once you're in a book, you won't die.
No, he won't.
Your name will be always out there.
Absolutely. Bob is very important to the Liberty story, as are you, Laura. And we appreciate that.
His last request was for the donations to go to the Liberty movie. He really felt so guilty because his ship didn't get to help. So that was his own last request.
I know.
To have that money go to the Liberty movie.
I know, Laura. And that was a beautiful request. And Al, I don't know if you knew about the Yellowstone or Bob yet.
First time I heard about it.
Yeah.
And I appreciate hearing about it because this is all part of what happened to the Liberty before and after that everybody should understand.
Thank you, Laura, so much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Nice talking to you again.
Always great to talk to you, and best to your family.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
She must be up in the years.
Yeah, Laura and Bob, great people. Yeah, it's she brought this very significant part of the Liberty.
If she hadn't spoken about it.
That's right. That's right.
And we wouldn't have any knowledge.
That's exactly right.
And thank goodness she's still around.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And sadly, as we said, Bob passed away relatively recently. And he really wants this story to get out to as many people as possible. And the Yellowstone was a significant part of the Liberty story, because here's another ship that could have, it was very close to the Liberty. It could have come to the aid of the Liberty, and yet they pulled it back. And could you imagine if the Yellowstone was allowed to assist? I mean, it was the queen of the tenders.
It would have been a great relief to everybody at the time.
Instead, they made you guys wait 16 hours. They made you wait through the night.
And there was a lot of wounded on board that could have benefited from the tender taking them, or even coming on board and treating them. It would have alleviated a lot of suffering and probably extended some of their lives.
Absolutely. 100%. That's the thing. They made you guys sit there from 2 o'clock in the afternoon local time until the attack, the massacre ended, which the actual attack itself, I think the total was about an hour. But obviously it was much more misery, you know, even before the reconnaissance flights for 6 hours and after. They made you wait until 6 in the morning the following day to get help. Here's some music. We'll be back, folks, in a few minutes. Well, I was just told by Ken we won't be back. That's the end of the show, because I guess we skipped a break. And thank you for listening. And enjoy the weekend, and God bless.